This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. The ability to know how a politician votes, is that part of democracy? Or actually, if you've got to protect that politician if they perceive a danger, a danger to them in this environment, this political environment we're in Northern Ireland. It's such an interesting story. There's been an ICO ruling around one of the incidents involving it. So have a listen and let me know what you think. At Stephen Nolan on Twitter. See you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock if you're listening to this later in the day. I'm slightly excitable today. I don't know what's wrong with me. Maybe all those sweets he ate, driving in the work. I'm joking. I'm trying the best. Haven't eaten anything yet.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. 6 minutes past nine, the Nolan Show from the BBC. Just to remind you about that breaking story we revealed just a couple of minutes ago, a 62-year-old man has been charged with harassment against the Education Minister, Paul Given. The charge follows a report to police of abusive emails on the 7th of February. Now, our top story today, this is a big story. This is crucially important for us all to discuss this morning. Elected representatives in Northern Ireland are entitled to anonymity in with regards to how they vote in certain circumstances if the political climate here means that they are at risk. This is the ruling from the Information Commissioner's Office. Let's get across the story then, because this story isn't just about what has happened in this instance. It's whether this could spread more in Northern Ireland, where people are able to argue that their decisions about policy issues which affect your lives can remain, their identities can remain anonymous. It comes after the loyalist Jimmy Bryson attempted to obtain the names of councillors involved in a call-in motion to halt the flying of the Union flag 365 days per year from war memorials in the Ards and North Down Council area. So this call-in motion, you'll hear us talk about it today, it meant that a majority vote of councillors to fly the flag permanently was overturned. And those call-in motions have been built into local government here in Northern Ireland. They're designed to be a protection for minorities. But various parties here in Northern Ireland have been accused of abusing the system. So the council, in this instance, refused to reveal the names of the councillors after objections from the councillors involved. It went to the Information Commissioner, and this is where it gets really interesting for all of you listening to the programme this morning. The Information Commissioner said, the ruling said, the Commissioner accepts that elected representatives hold public office and to a degree that their actions will fall under public scrutiny. When councillors make representations on behalf of the public, there is an expectation that they do so publicly, transparently, and in accordance with legislation. But, and here's the story, the Commissioner also accepts that there are certain sensitive topics in Northern Ireland politics which make it more problematic for elected representatives, especially when these representatives are in a minority. The Commissioner is aware that the flying of flags in Northern Ireland is an extremely sensitive topic. Therefore, it is considered reasonable for these individuals to expect council to protect their identities when asked to do so, especially if there is a potential for harm or danger if the information is disclosed. Jimmy Bryson questioned this. You approached the Information Commissioner, Jimmy. This could set a significant precedent in Northern Ireland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Stephen. Well, yes, it could, and not only in Northern Ireland, across the United Kingdom, because the Information Commissioner's Office aren't a Northern Ireland body alone. It's a UK-wide body alone. So, I mean, this is actually a UK story, because if you apply the same principle, if there's contentious issues in England, maybe perhaps immigration, the issues in Southport, matters like that, then the same principle would apply. So it's a very important story. It is important just to say at the outset that actually the call-in itself was deemed unlawful. I succeeded in a judicial review. Mr. Justice Humphreys quashed that decision. So actually the exercise of the power was unlawful. And we're still not allowed to know who did it. But the decision of the Information Commissioner, you know, is wrong in a number of places. It essentially subjectively allows elected members to decide if they should have an expectation that their public acts as elected representatives, not as acts as personal people who go before the electorate, get a mandate and purport to exercise these powers and have these powers on behalf of the public, that if they decide, well, we think that this should be secret, that they have that expectation.
Well, it's about their safety in the political context of Northern Ireland, isn't it?
Very simple. Well, the first thing is first, on that, if we just deal with that factual issue before the wider principle, the factual issue, and Mr. David Thompson in the newsletter said, reported this, PS and I have been very clear, no reports of any safety concerns whatsoever, no evidence for it, and essentially these alliance councillors have put forward these assertions in the absence of any evidence in order to allow
them. Well, the alliance councillors have made a representation to the Information Commissioner, and the Information Commissioner has found there to be grounds.
That's been appealed, and I like my hat if it's not overturned on appeal. But the issue is this. Alliance are the party who tells us all about accountability, about transparency, about accountable decision-making in the public arena. And the Alliance Party are then saying, we deserve the right to exercise what Mr. Justice Humphreys described as very significant and unusual powers to overturn the normal workings of democracy. We deserve the right to use that, and we'll do so anonymously, and we won't be accountable to the public for that. So how politics works, people are elected in a democratic society. In being elected, they are given privileges and powers which they don't exercise personally, but as holders of that elected office on behalf of the people who put them there. And the next time an election comes, people are entitled to look at their representative and say, well, this is what they've done with the powers I give them. Do I want to hold them accountable and kick them out of office because I don't like what they've done, or do I like what they've done? But we now have a circumstance where these alliance councillors think, well, we can't and won't be held accountable for what we've done because we'll do it in secret. So let's follow this to its logical endpoint. Let's take the most controversial issue in Northern Ireland in generations, the protocol, the most controversial issue. So the next time there's a protocol vote in Stormont, by logical extension, are Alliance entitled to say...
Well, it's not just Alliance, is it? It's any party, any politician.
Well, Alliance have made the representations. So nobody else has come forward and made the representations. Alliance have made these representations. So this is not any other. So if there's another parties in the council coming forward and saying this, then yes, the focus would have to be on everybody. But let's be fair. This is driven by the Alliance Party. The Alliance Party have made these representations. So it's they who the focus should be on. And the Alliance Party are the party.
You seem obsessed with the Alliance Party this morning.
Because the Alliance Party are the ones who have made the representation. There's no other party who is objecting.
Well, but the point of this story this morning is that other parties may use it, and there may be good reason. It's about the safety and the protection of our public representatives, isn't it? Now, just wait one moment. And if we go back to 2012, during the flag protests, Michael and Christine Barr, married Alliance councillors, had the window of their home smashed in Bangor in December 2012 during those flag protests as they put their 17-month-old daughter to bed. This is how real it can be.
Our daughter's life could have been lost tonight, potentially. Is anything worth this? Is a flag worth this? Seriously, people need to get their acts together.
I don't see why we deserve to be attacked when we work for people in our community. We try our best. You may not agree with us, but please don't attack us in a physical way. I just gone to bed with Grace. So the bed is just below the window. Whenever I realised what had happened, sorry, Sorry, the glass has just fallen off the window there. As soon as I realised what had happened, I was extremely upset. I couldn't stop shaking and just beside myself. And as you can see, how jumpy we were there.
So that's how real it can be. 17-month-old child, Jimmy Bryson, and a family having their window put in. And that's what the Information Commissioner, that type of incident, is talking about when people's safety are at risk.
2 points on that. The first point is starting way back whenever you began there about what parties and other parties might use this. Well, I think, respectfully, in the public interest, the BBC just simply ought to go to every party and ask them, do you support this and will you use the anonymity provision? So that would answer that question. The second thing is this, as a matter of broad principle, if you get into the situation in any democratic society where you say those who disgracefully and despicably engage in unlawful behaviour, we will allow them a veto and we will gradually move democracy into secret and behind closed doors. That's the end of democracy. So will Parliament start sitting in secret to debate controversial issues? Will Stormont start sitting in secret to debate controversial issues? The way to deal with people who engage in unlawful acts...
Well, the debate wasn't secret. It's how they voted.
Is to use the... Well, they exercise... So this call-in power is given... It's a very controversial power. There's all sorts of issues with it. That was acknowledged and that
that's a different story.
And yes, but there's all sorts of issues with that power. But in any event, it is what it is. And so you have a minority who can overturn the democratic wishes of the majority. And the people of the borough, of the local council area, are not entitled to know which elected representatives exercise that power. So you could have somebody who says, "Why did my elected representative not try and stop those flags on War Memorials? I don't want flags on War Memorials." You might have somebody that says, "I think that's an appalling decision. Why would you stop flags on War Memorials?" And that's a matter of politics at the ballot box, which you should be held accountable for. And people may like that approach you've taken or may not, but in this circumstance, they can't be held accountable. In fact, they could lie about whether they even used a call-in power or not, because there would be no means of holding them accountable. So you get into a situation where you have public decision-makers entitled to make decisions in private, in secret, and they can't be held publicly accountable for. That is a very, very slippery slope, and more so in the absence of... The PSNI have been very clear. David Thompson has reported it today. They have not received any reports at all of any safety concerns or any, so there's not even a factual basis for this, never mind the broader principle.
Let's see what you think at home about this. 030 30 80 55 55. The SDLP councillor Carl White with us this morning. Good morning to you, Carl.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, there is a strong argument, isn't there, for open democracy, and if you don't know what your elected representatives, which way they're voting, how can you vote for them come election time?
We have called, among other parties in Belfast and other councils, for increased transparency at councils and the large number of items on agendas that are restricted, which means they're not discussed in public, and we are very clear in our opposition to that. That's not what this issue is about, though, and nor is the Information Commissioner finding, or even the court case, which actually the judgment stated that the flying of flags is properly a matter for political judgment rather than assessment by any court. The issue here is, and you had a very emotional interview there with two parents with their child whose home had been attacked for their position on flags. There is a litany online of stories of attacks on public representatives because of the positions they've taken on flags. So I understand, and the Commission understands, and it's stated very clearly, councillors are fearful of being targeted for attempting to challenge a council decision on the flying of flags on War Memorials 365 days a year. So no one is suggesting that there's some cabal of councillors in Ards and North Down who aren't in my party, who are against transparency, against openness, against being held accountable. What they're against is having their names publicised and then their homes being attacked with their wives and children.
But you can understand, surely, Carl, what the potential... We get what the potential strengths are against this, for this, that it might prevent someone being attacked. But there are many different people in different public walks of life who they have to, they've no choice to but to embrace the dangers of the political situation in Northern Ireland. Our police officers who are under death threats from dissidents. They can't walk around all day with masks on. They're public facing, and there is no anonymity around them whatsoever when they're doing their job.
But Stephen, you'll know that our police force is the only one in the UK who are issued with personal protection weapons.
That's how dangerous it is.
And so they are afforded protection. But what we're saying here, not you, but it's been suggested that councillors shouldn't be afforded any level of protection. And the Information Commissioner Office, their report recognises the importance of transparency.
But where does this stop?
It recognises that there's a legitimate interest in knowing who these representatives are, that there's a necessity test that is passed. But overall, you still have rights to not have your home attacked, not have
Carl, this is such an interesting story. Because once someone says that they have the perception in their mind that they may be under a risk depending on what way they vote as a public representative. So what's to stop MLAs in the future saying, do you know what? We're dealing with abortion today and it's a very controversial subject and I'm afraid of my home being attacked and therefore we won't know how political representatives vote on something as divisive and as controversial and as important as abortion. And then you do take the REC border. Bryson brought it up a minute or two ago. So does it become more a divisive than that? We won't know how any elected representative votes on it if they say they're in danger. Where does democracy go if that happens?
No, I think that's hyperbole with respect.
Why? You're
not,
why?
Because abortion activists have not targeted public representatives' homes with criminal acts, with violence, with attacks.
But
they haven't, Stephen. And nor have, on Windsor Framework vote, I don't recall any public representative's home or business or their office being attacked the way.
But it doesn't have to be a real threat, does it? It's not relevant whether it's happened or not. It's whether there is a perceived danger.
No, I think that the ICO have taken a judgment. And if you read the judgment, and you have, you'll see that they have taken on board the views of councillors that they're fearful of being targeted. So that's a very specific word and it has legal significance. So what does that mean, being targeted?
The police are targeted in this country. Journalists are targeted in this country. Many different people of different walks of life, Carl, are targeted in this country because of the toxic nature of the politics.
Yeah, well, you gave the example of the police. They have protections. Certain politicians are afforded protection as well. Public councillors aren't. And by the way, the measure that was proposed here, which is that the flags fly up from War Memorial 365 days, it's through anyway. So those who signed the call in, and it's very important that we have their names public for some reason, actually they failed. So the measure's through anyway.
Yeah, only because I took them to the High Court. That's only the reason they failed.
You applied for judicial review, which passed on the fact that you correctly pointed out that December the 27th was a working day and the council disagreed.
So it was unlawful.
The judgment's very clear.
Carl, was the call-in unlawful? I think
we're going down a different route here than the story we're doing this morning.
It's interesting because one of the issues the story is about is the flying flag. And
no,
it's an interesting judgment.
No, it's not. The story this morning, Carl. Look, I know what the story is this morning because I'm hosting the show.
Okay.
The story this morning is about whether the citizens of this country ought to know who is voting and how they are voting in every single case, or, as you're pointing out, Carl, whether if there is a perceived threat to any of our elected representatives, that they are able to hide their vote.
I think it's more, and we've supported transparency. We're one of the parties in Belfast that have called for a reduction of restricted meetings. Call-in procedures are used by all parties across councils in Northern Ireland, so it might be worth asking other parties do they use them, because they do. But the important point is here, perceived threat. Well, it was a perceived threat that became an actual threat for Alliance and SDLP representatives in the past on this issue. And that is why the ICO have ruled the way they did. Let me say something else. If loyalists hadn't attacked those houses and hadn't attacked those representatives and their families, then I don't think I think that the point you're making would it be harder to substantiate?
Okay.
Because the councillors would have been...
I'll let you respond, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Well, the central flaw in Carl's approach is that, as you identified, this is entirely subjective. So what the ICU have done is allowed the councillors to decide if they perceive subjectively there's a threat, and they have then said, if you subjectively perceive that, then that means that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So they've allowed themselves to determine whether they have an expectation of privacy or not. That's simply wrong. That should be an objective test. Sorry, that's exactly right as a matter of law, Carl. No. It's an objective test as to whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. The person who has searched privacy doesn't decide subjectively whether they have or not. So clearly, so you're wrong on that.
The report refers to the...
Sorry, Carl, just I listened to your, monologue.
Yeah, you're listening
to mine, so if you could just be quiet for a minute. Stephen made another very good point there. What about journalists in Northern Ireland? I watched a sitting of the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee the other week. Malachy O'Dougherty, Alison Morris, somebody from the NUJ, were talking about the threats, paramilitary threats that journalists receive, some of them who live in houses with bulletin bomb-proof doors. Are we then saying that the media, I think, Stephen, have you not received threats in the past? Other journalists have received threats, abuse on social media. Are we then saying that the standard of journalism in Northern Ireland, journalists should now be anonymous? There should be no names in any stories. Because there's been threats to journalists in the past.
Well,
so the problem in Carl's position is, where does this end? And that's what he can't answer, because there's no limit to this.
Well, I can't answer it, because...
So where's the limit? Tell me where the limit is.
Well, let him answer.
The ICU report sets out that there is a legitimate interest in finding this information out, that it passes the necessity test, but the third test, which comes to other people's rights, and you don't have exclusive rights to transparency if it means that right... being given and being bestowed on a process means that that those people's homes, businesses, offices are then attacked by paramilitary groups, and that
nobody
is what...
Nobody said it. Sorry. It was not found as a fact that was going to happen. The police have had no reports. So nobody in the SDLP or Alliance or anybody else has went to the police and said, goodness me, we feel under threat, please protect us, this is a big issue. None of that has happened. They subjectively said this was they could keep their actions private and secret. Now, that is the issue.
I don't know how you know what these counselors have said. I don't know how you know, because it's not in the report. And the point is, as I made earlier, I'm going to finish this point.
Now, hold on. Let's let Carl
finish. There would be no expectation from the ICO that there would be any attacks or targeting if those attacks and targeting hadn't already taken place. The ICO actually,
in the ruling, expand this beyond this case, because what they say in one of the paragraphs, they say the commissioner also accepts that there are certain sensitive topics, plural, in Northern Ireland politics, which make it more problematic for elected representatives, especially when these representatives are in a minority. So they're hinting here, aren't they, that there will be a range of topics where they may rule that an elected representative can keep secret how they have voted. Martin Rosenbaum is an FOI expert. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
It's such interesting territory. I'm probably boring people saying that, but it is, because in Northern Ireland, trust in politics and people understanding what their politicians are about and how they vote and how they don't may be incredibly important to them here.
Well, I think it's important to people everywhere, and it seems to me it's a fundamental principle of a democratic society that people know what are the political stances that their elected representatives are taking on their behalf, so that they can decide whether or not they want to vote for them in future. And that's part of what democracy is about.
But you don't have democracy if you have people being politicians just because of how they vote, or having their homes attacked and not able to do their job.
That's absolutely something that's got to be tackled where it happens. I think the issue here, it seems to me, is what is the balance of the circumstances in this particular case? Having read the Information Commissioner's judgment, it seems to me that they're being very ultra-cautious here. And I am also a bit worried about the precedent that it could set for other situations. One decision from the Information Commissioner does not set a legal precedent directly that would directly affect other circumstances. Everything's got to be decided on its own particular case. But in practice, you do sometimes get the situation that a decision from the Information Commissioner does influence what councils do and what the commissioner does in future.
So could, for example, if we take other topic areas here in Northern Ireland, could an elected representative, a politician, Martin, approach the Information Commissioner and say, look, I note what you did in the case over the flags. I'm now voting on abortion. I'm now voting on the Irish Sea border. And I feel that my home or my person would be under attack if this becomes public. And I don't want any information to be disclosed. Would there be any weight to that?
Well,
because of
really
what's happened here.
Sure. So there would be some weight to it, but the issue really, they ought to be in a position where they're providing evidence to say that genuinely threats have been made. There are reasons to take those.
But there are no threats in this case. That's the point.
And talking about the basis on which the commissioner should take a decision, it should take that kind of situation into account. But I think the other thing just to bear in mind here is, as Jimmy Bryson said, this case is being appealed. And so in a few months, we will probably have a decision from the tribunal. And we won't really know what the impact of this case will be until we've had the decision from the tribunal. And I think the tribunal is likely to go into all of this in much more detail as to the nature of what the threat might be. There may be witnesses who give evidence and are cross-examined on it in a way in which the commissioner doesn't do. That might establish, first of all, more about the sort of facts behind the case, but also it may lead to a different decision and the tribunal may overturn the commissioner's decision. So I think we've just got to bear that point in mind as well.
Davidson Bangor. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen. Good programme as usual.
Thank you.
Good old Donald is breaking the world up at the moment and changing everything that Biden did and maybe bringing a glimmer of peace in Ukraine. However, what he's talking about mostly is common sense. The last thing we're talking about this morning about these councillors who have abrogated to themselves the right to hide from the voters, people who voted for them, the way they voted in committee or whatever. Now, this is nonsense, isn't it? If you join politics, you have to put your head above the parapet.
Well, that's all very well until you're sitting with your child and you get a brick through the window because of how you voted.
That can happen. That's what politics...
You mean, well, that can happen? That's not
yes,
what
that
politics is all about.
The thing is, William, Stephen, this is what politics is. Now, if you don't want it, you can walk away. This is a risk that every politician takes. Everywhere, not just here. So somebody once said, American president, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. You can't have it both ways. As you rightly said, what about journalists? Journalists don't publish things under an anonymous name.
Well, actually, sometimes what newspapers do, as an example, sometimes you'll see stories and it just says staff reporter. In fact, newspapers do withdraw names sometimes.
Well, yes, they can do
from
that,
articles
for
lots of different reasons.
On major issues and big scoops, you'll never see any reporter mentioned. The names are always clear when it's a big story. And most of these things are big stories
okay.
we're talking about.
David, thank
so
you.
The journalists show the way. So if a politician doesn't want to have any trouble, he shouldn't get into politics.
David, thank you very much.
Stephen, sorry, I have to go now.
All right, good man. We'll pause there. Here comes the news at 9:33. Discussing this ruling by the Information Commissioner that politicians under certain circumstances, certain sensitive topics in Northern Irish politics, says the Commissioner, make it more problematic for elected representatives, especially when these representatives are in a minority. Jimmy Bryson, let me hear your understanding of how intimidating it must be in Northern Ireland, given how people can be very intimidating here, for a politician to be frightened about how they vote, because it might bring danger and violence to their family or themselves. Should we not be thinking about that and what
well,
we can do?
If you're talking to somebody who lives under threat, I'm going to guarantee you there's very few of any politicians in Northern Ireland who have had as many death threats as I have. I could wallpaper my house with them. I mean, if you want me to bring you up to the BBC, they're in the hundreds. delivered by the PSNI all of the time, whose home has been attacked, who lives under constant threat. So, I mean, if you want to talk to somebody about living under threat and living under daily social media abuse to the AIDS, that's not only to me, but to my family, to my son, my child. So I know all about living under threat. So, you know, you're speaking to the right person in respect of that. But the issue here is this. If somebody threatens to break the law, the answer is not to put democracy into a darkened room. It is to shine democracy even brighter and to deal with the people who break the law. So if people engage in intimidation, in threats, in attacks, then the answer to that is to deal with those people via the process of law and order, via the police, that's the system we have in the United Kingdom, and to put them in jail. It's not to move democracy
and
into
that
a darkened
is,
room.
And
because, hold on, you start by moving democracy into a darkened room on the basis of a perceived and subjective necessity, and that's how tyranny starts. That's how you end up like in a Stalinist state. Whenever you, what is the limits? There's no limits here. So somebody comes along and says, my goodness, the Irish Sea border, Leo Varadkar was threatened in relation to that. There was buses burnt on the Shankill Road. I'm terrified. I don't want to get involved in that. I'm voting in secret to continue Articles 5 to 10, to continue the Irish Sea border, and that person can't be held accountable by the electorate. So the issue here is this. It's very, very simple. If there's threats, if there's unlawful behaviour, that's a matter
well,
for the police,
but,
and the police should deal with it.
Yes, but saying, Jimmy, one moment, saying that the police should deal with it, that's, you write that down in a glossy brochure and put it in your drawer compared to the reality of Northern Ireland.
Where's the limit,
which
Stephen?
Is this.
Where's
Hold on,
limit?
Let me finish the question, which is, you know, and everybody listening to this programme knows, that paramilitaries and other sinister forces in Northern Ireland are quite good at getting away with it, are quite good that they are never brought to justice because the community or individuals are terrified of testifying against them. They get burnt out. They sometimes get driven out. They sometimes get shot. So with that context, which you know very well, how do we protect our good elected representatives from intimidation?
You don't protect democracy by giving a veto to those who would threaten violence. So you don't say to people, if you engage unlawfully, the consequences of your unlawful actions is you're going to force democracy into a darkened room.
Okay, Carl.
So actually, so how you protect people is by more democracy, not less, by more transparency.
Carl, how would you respond to this? Because the information, just before you go, Carl, the Information Commissioner, I note, has also said the following. It is considered reasonable for individuals to expect counsel to protect their identities when asked to do so, especially if there is a potential, so not real, a potential for harm or danger if this information is disclosed. So it's a potential for it. And the Information Commissioner also says, equally, councillors should have no expectation that their identities will not be disclosed in normal circumstances when undertaking public business.
Well, any threats, including those that Jamie Bryson has outlined, are a disgrace and should be condemned. And the stress that people live under having to deal with those is not what anybody wants anybody else to go through. How do you deal with this, Stephen? This has been, and you've highlighted that there's a potential free speech here issue and transparency issue, and I understand that. The reality is, though, we do live in a different place. There is an issue where there have been homes targeted and people attacked. And on this one single issue, there is no precedent established by ICO rulings. The court judgment was on procedure. It wasn't on the issue. In fact, it very clearly said on flag this was political. So there isn't going to be a case where democracy dies and goes into darkness and transparency disappears. If any councillor from our party started going to the ICO about issues that were normal day-to-day politics, well, there would be an issue with that, and I'm sure there would be with other parties. So listeners can be assured that this isn't some sort of attempt by anyone to pull the wool over anybody else's eyes. There's a legitimate reason here. And going back to what one of your callers said, you know, politicians don't sign up to run for elected office to have death threats and things thrown at their homes. No, they don't. And if that's the road you want to go down, you're going to find very few people that actually want to run and be involved in electoral politics.
Carl, could we get a wee list? See, you just said there, you know, if anybody, speaking for the SLP, obviously you said anybody in your party went to the ICO about all the issues. Could you maybe, for the public, give a wee list of what issues they could go on in terms to hold their public functions secret? Is there a limit?
You told me to be quiet earlier. Now you've asked me a question, you don't even let me finish. You know, so I'm not going to do you the discourtesy of telling you to be quiet.
Come on, you finish your sentence, Carl.
It's a good question. I'll switch it around. The answer is, any issue where people's lives are at risk, they have a legitimate reason to go and seek their names and their, which allows them their addresses to be found easily through electoral registers and all of that. They want to protect their homes and their lives and their livelihoods. It's very simple.
But any issue, is it not the case, Carl? Is it not the case?
See, just on the last issue, Stephen, because I think it was Malia Cahill took a case in respect of this. There is actually provision for elected representatives to have their names and addresses, taken off the electoral register and not to be published on electoral forms. So there actually is protections there to have your address removed if you feel in fear. And I mind that Malia Cahill, when she was an FDLP councillor, I think she took a case, didn't want her address public standing for election in one. Martin, so they can't do that.
Martin, could this become a UK story? And at what point is it likely to?
Theoretically, it could, in the same kind of arguments that are being presented here could be presented in with regard to other topics in other places that they're particularly sensitive issues. But it's obviously the case that it's much less likely for that to happen elsewhere in the UK and in Northern Ireland at the moment. So I would say, on the basis of this judgment from the Information Commissioner, that is very much situated in the circumstances of Northern Ireland politics. And although in principle the same arguments could be applied elsewhere, it doesn't look to me that in itself is very likely.
What are the particular circumstances of Northern Irish politics which make us so different? What are they?
Well, the sort of things that you've been talking about on the programme so far, of councillors and politicians being under threat and the protection that they need in certain circumstances.
But politicians have been stabbed to death and murdered in England.
That is absolutely truly the case. There's obviously more of that in Northern Ireland. And I think that the situation that the ICO is referring to, the arguments they're using, are situated in the historical circumstances.
Yes, historical. But is it actually more dangerous to be a politician in Northern Ireland than across the water? Have times not changed? Is it not equally as dangerous across the UK to be a politician? No, I'm asking that genuinely, openly.
There are definitely dangers about being a politician throughout the UK. Comparing it to the particular situation in Northern Ireland, to be honest, you're probably better able to comment on that than I am, Stephen, and maybe some of the other people who you have on your programme. But just trying to answer the question of to what extent this decision is likely to impact on the rest of the UK, I think if you read it, is very much situated in the circumstances of Northern Ireland. And although, you know, in principle the arguments could be applied, and you're quite right to say there are issues across the UK as a whole, it seems to me that the Information Commissioner's Office has decided very much to situate things in the situation in Northern Ireland.
Okay. Martin, thank you. Jamie Bryson, thank you. Carl, thank you very much indeed. Councillor Carl White from SDLP, thank you. I think it's a programme we should contact the Speaker, actually, Edwin Poots, and just ask Edwin Poots if he foresees any situation in which the voting register in Stormont could be anonymised, and just get Speaker Poots' reaction to this. We will do that as a programme. Jason and Coleraine. Morning, Jason.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Yes, the point I would like, they're mentioning this secrecy and security about their voting. Okay. But you see, when it comes to the council election, they'll put their names and faces on every lamppost in Northern Ireland. Is that not harming their security then? When they're looking like you to go out and vote for them, they will quite happily put their face and their name up. But they'll not tell you, they don't want to tell you now what way they're voting. That's against them, actually.
Jason, thank you. Brian, morning, Brian.
Morning, Stephen. Right, listen, I think this is a great idea. I think the Information Office are giving, I think, our politicians a chance to be safer here. And that, to me, is what it's all about. I've had this fear this last few years with what's happened in England, that inevitably we will, hopefully not, but inevitably have a politician that will be badly injured, or as was mentioned earlier, a child could have been killed or badly maimed in some shape or form. So I think from a civilised society, we don't have anything to worry about. What we have to worry about is bad people or unelected people on the periphery sort of gouging away at what politicians are trying to do, which is to try and make this a better place. So I believe we need to protect those politicians, and it will only apply to contentious decisions, I can assure you.
And Brian, what's not contentious in Northern Ireland? Isn't everything nearly contentious in Northern Ireland?
Like politically contentious in the sense of flags and identities and so forth. Those are the things that do raise people's eyebrows. The majority of us are sensible in our approach to that, but it's the minority we have to be careful about. I want councillors, I often thought of it myself, of getting involved, but quite frankly, you know, I think for people to put themselves up there, they deserve the entitlement of protection, particularly over issues that you and I know will inflame the bigoted sides. And that's what we have to avoid here. We do not wait until we have a councillor or an MLA stabbed, or a vicious attack that was intent to cause fear, which goes wrong from the perpetrator's point of view and ends up maiming or killing somebody. I simply do back this wholeheartedly. Okay.
Brian, thank you very much. Morning to you. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call. Let's look at a business story next. Triple whammy of increased national insurance, the living wage, high rates set to create a cost of doing business crisis in Northern Ireland, according to Retail NI. They did a survey with a questionnaire, polled members on how the rise in the rate of national insurance paid by employers that's coming this April would impact their businesses. 74% said they would have to either reduce staff or staffing hours. 86% claimed they can't scale up their business or have cancelled expansion plans due to increased financial pressure. Retail NI is now also calling for the government at all levels, from local council to Westminster, to take action. The Ulster Unionist Party MLA, Dana Armstrong, has been speaking to me this morning, and I asked her to spell out how businesses in her area are describing the pressure.
Businesses, yes, are indicating that. We've seen the Retail NI Summit today is going to address the call for action. So businesses are facing so many hurdles coming down the track. We're all aware of the increase in employers' national insurance, the rise in the minimum wage, overhead rates, overhead costs. It's a real tsunami coming at the business sector.
Well, it is, isn't it? And yet, what's the solution?
Well, I think the solution is I know the finance minister has, the previous finance minister, Dr. Archibald, commissioned cost of doing business survey and also the rates relief review, or the rates review. So those will be coming in March. And I think that will really focus the pressures that there are on this sector. And I think from the Ulster Unionist Party's point of view, we support the economy. We want to see it grow. These businesses, particularly high street businesses, which is part of the summit today, are crucial in the forward-looking economy for Northern Ireland. So the finance minister needs to bring forward a range of measures targeted to support the small business sector, including rates relief, including looking at ways of supporting businesses so that we do not lose businesses within this environment. Crucially, also in the survey by Retail NI, 74% of respondents indicated they would reduce number of employees as well as reduce staff working hours. So it's a matter of addressing job losses coming forward.
Well, your party is in the executive, Diana, so you know how tight money is. Mike Nesbitt, who is within your party, obviously, the health minister, he is desperate for money. So you take this money away, you subsidise rates, you take it away from other things. Is that really the way to go here and give it to business?
There are different ways of looking at it. This what we need to do is look at where there's vacant land, where vacant land is not paying rates. Look at derelict buildings, and I'm pleased to see a dilapidation bill coming through to address that. We make those who own or who are connected with dilapidated buildings will be called to account, and that money can be recouped in to help the business sector.
Well, the finance minister is saying, look, 29,000 businesses from a database of 75,000 receive a reduction of between 20 to 50%. And he is saying, John O'Dowd is saying, any rate relief means foregoing revenue or charging other rate payers more, while every pound raised through the rating system, he says, stays here as a resource to help pay for hospitals, schools and other public services.
Well, if we look at the rates relief given in GB, the rates relief to the retail sector was 75% and then reduced to 40%. That came across to the Northern Ireland executives as a Barnett consequential, which did not feed through to the business
because
sector.
Because it's going to other things. These are hard choices, though, Dan, aren't they? So you take it away from where? Where do you take the money away from?
They are hard choices, but this is across the entire United Kingdom as a result of the Chancellor's budget. Every sector will be feeling this squeeze, and it is a squeeze that means jobs are going to be lost, that means businesses are going to have to pay more in employers' national insurance. So the challenge is for the Finance Minister to find this or to go to the UK government and seek further intervention.
But going cap in hand to the UK government hasn't really paid off so far, has it? They're not going to give us more money, are they?
Well, I think the case has to be made in this particular... The disastrous outworkings of the Chancellor's budget is not only Northern Ireland that is going to be going to the Treasury saying this, because this has a UK-wide impact.
OK. And what are businesses saying to you, just finally, Diana? Is this the worst it's ever been?
This is the worst it's ever been. Businesses are reducing opening hours currently at the moment. In the bigger picture, Northern Ireland's high streets, Northern Ireland's businesses are a showcase for this country. When you have foreign direct investment coming in, when you have tourists coming, they want to see a vibrant economy in the small business sector on our high streets. And when we have derelict buildings and closed down buildings, people will turn away. We see stagnation in the high street, and that has to be addressed.
Okay. Dana, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll come back to that story after 10 this morning. 030 30 80 55 55. Here's another story now. On Friday's programme, we brought you an interview with the family of a dementia patient who told us he's been effectively left homeless as he waits in hospital for a care home bed.
The care home manager, and I have to say we both supported her point of view that he couldn't return there because he had a duty of care to her staff and her residents. So he ended up in a critical care ward and he's still there.
He's still in hospital?
He's still in hospital. He's been there for 4 weeks.
Well, the stark message from the Belfast Trust was currently there's very limited availability of care home beds for older people with complex care needs. Here's another example. Lindsay, morning to you, Lindsay.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You contacted me about your dad.
I did, Stephen. Thanks for taking the time to speak to me. I just want to let you know that I didn't take the decision to ring the show lightly. This has just that story of that other family resonates very close to home. We're in a similar position with my father, who is in a care home at the minute, and the family and care home all agree that it's not a suitable place for him to be. They can't manage his needs. But my issue is that we've been waiting to get him placed in another home since last May. There may be current pressures on the system, but we have been trying to get him placed since May. His situation intensified sort of September, October last year. And we have went to look at a number of homes and been told by the Trust of the places that were available at the time. And when we agreed to move him, then within a day, those places, we were told, no, sorry, they're not suitable for him. So his current home have issued him on the 1st of February with notice to leave on the 28th, which is this Friday. And my father still does not have a place where to go. We as a family are sitting on Tuesday. We have no idea what is going to happen on Friday when he's to leave the current home that he's in.
So what will happen to him? He'd be homeless.
I don't know, Stephen. Well, in effect, yes, we're being told no, he won't be homeless. But we were then contacted by the Trust last Thursday to say that they were considering potentially placing him in a mental health unit until they found a place for him. They said it wasn't for because they had no place, but it was to assess him, which he's had any number of assessments by dementia care teams, by mental health nurses. He doesn't need any further assessment. He has an Alzheimer's diagnosis, which has been in place since July 22. All assessments have been completed. So they're now potentially talking about placing him in a mental health unit because they have nowhere else to put him.
How do you feel about that?
Extremely distressing for him. I feel absolutely disgusted, Stephen, and I feel let down by the whole system. And just we're desperate as a family, which is why we've had to get in touch with yourselves, because we've nowhere else to turn at this point. But we've written to our local MLA, who have sent two letters to the trust on our behalf, and we feel that we've explored every avenue. And I think it is worth stating, Stephen, that we have a good relationship with the social workers looking after my dad. They're doing the best they can, but they're stuck in a system where nothing is moving, and even what they're relaying to their superiors just seems to be falling on deaf ears. I don't know what's going on. We're totally hopeless at this point.
The trusts are essentially saying in their statement that there's limited availability. I wonder, does that mean none? Because if there was any availability, why would they not give it to someone like your dad? Maybe there are other people in front of him. I don't know. But there's certainly no... They're saying there's limited availability. There's no availability to your father, is there? Or he would be offered somewhere.
Back in October, Stephen, my sister and I were told by the trust to go and look at a home that we were reluctant to look at. It was actually a staff trust home. We were reluctant to look at this home because we didn't think it would be suitable. But again, we went with an open mind to look at it. We were pleasantly surprised by the home, and the staff in it were lovely. We thought it would be very suitable for him. We went on a Saturday morning. We agreed that yes, we would be happy to place him here. We approached the social worker on Monday to say that yes, we will go. He can go there. When we visited that home, the staff member that showed us around told us they had 7 beds available at that point in time in October because they'd had 4 rooms just refurbished. So we went back and said that yes, we were happy for him to go there. And on Tuesday, we were told, no, he's not suitable. We need to review his care and we're not placing him there. So he could have been placed in a home back in October had they wanted to place him then. So there's obviously bigger issues at play in the care system that we're not privy to those details as to why they're not placing people in homes when places are becoming available, because the nature of those homes is that unfortunately people pass away and places become available.
So why do you think they're not? So if you're saying there are places, which is what you're saying, aren't you? Why do you
think? Well, I know there's limited places. There's not a lot of places. I'm not saying, but all I know, all I can speak about is at that point in October, that one particular home had beds available.
So what do you think's going on, Lindsay?
I have absolutely no idea, Stephen, what is going on. And my belief is that hospitals are under pressure. They're trying to discharge patients and they're discharging them into trust homes. I think because my father was already in a home, he wasn't treated as urgent because he was already in somewhere. So they didn't see his case as urgent to move him. They've had months to find a suitable place for him and it's now become urgent where he needs to go on Friday. We have no idea if we have to go as a family, collect him from his current home on Friday, and what we're to do with him or where we have to take him.
They're not telling you what to do. They're not telling you what you can do.
Be homeless. But we don't know what we have to do. No, we have no idea. It was interesting when I spoke to your show this morning that they had got the standard response from the trust that the trust is under pressure. But no one has come back to me. The last I heard from the trust was Thursday. No one spoke. When I come off the phone from you today, I'm going to have to phone them myself to find out what I can do.
Well, they are publicly saying that they're currently working to establish home placement. They'll continue in their efforts to resolve this and will keep the family involved. I'll tell you what, come back onto this programme on Friday, all right? So that's my commitment to you. If you're available, come on Friday. And if they're publicly saying that they'll keep you informed, let's see what they do between now and Friday. Is that all right, Lindsay?
Yeah. Yeah, well, they have to do something. The home that my dad is in at the minute, actually, in the letter.
Stay there, Lindsay. Stay there. We'll come back to you after.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
It was very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history music recording with Brian Eno and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So good morning to you. 4 minutes past ten. We're just in the middle of this story with Lindsay this morning. Her father, the Belfast Trust, Lindsay tells us, are wanting to move her father into a mental health unit because they can't find a bed for him. He's got Alzheimer's. Our health correspondent, Mary-Louise Connolly, has been listening this morning. Mary-Louise, good morning to you.
Stephen.
And yet another example of the consequences of the pressure on beds and the lack of availability for people who need them.
Exactly, Stephen. And unfortunately, you know, Keith and many of the people that the Nolan programme speaks to, they're not individual cases. There are many, many, many people like them out there. And in fact, would you believe, are in a worse situation. I'm aware, or was aware, of a man who was in the Royal Victoria Hospital for about 16 weeks because they couldn't find a hospital bed. And the family were going around care homes, nursing homes themselves, trying to access beds. And sadly, their father passed away in January. So Keith's case, you know, it's not unique. And it's sadly because Northern Ireland's social care system, critics would say it's broken. It's been broken for a very long time. We don't have the workforce to support the number of people who require social care. And we simply don't have the places either.
And so what have patients ultimately, I wonder, Mary-Louise, got legal rights against this, or can they just be moved into mental health units and other units which are not appropriate for their care?
Well, clearly being moved into a mental health unit isn't appropriate. And you know, we hear also, Stephen, of young people, whether being on the verge of 17 and 18, and it's that limbo time of, you know, you're not quite an adult, but they have nowhere to place you, nowhere suitable to place you. And because beds are at a premium within either a dementia ward, it means that if a bed becomes available in another ward, where perhaps you are in a mixed sex ward, or you are not in a ward which is looking after your speciality, what is specifically wrong with you? The trust will say, well, what else are we expected to do? We have to place this patient somewhere, and this is the only available bed. Families have argued about this and have fought this practice for years and years, but at the end of the day, their loved one has to be cared for somewhere and they have no other choice.
Mary-Louise, you're also looking today, aren't you, at equal access to healthcare and the review of how our hospitals work.
Yeah, and you know what, Stephen, it's all joined up. So despite us talking about hospitals today, because the consultation into this review of hospitals, it closes this Friday. Now, it's been ongoing for a couple of months. The public have been able to have their say. I don't think a lot of people actually have been aware of this consultation. It's quite lengthy. It's complicated. But when you log on to the actual document, it's 115 pages long. It doesn't really give you any clue about what those potential changes might be. The Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, joins a long list of ministers who has wanted to shake up the hospital system. The idea is of a network of hospitals. We are quite small in Northern Ireland, only 1.9 million people. And the idea is that we are small enough to have across the counties a number of specialist hospitals. For instance, any woman who wakes up and discovers a lump in her breast, that you would be prepared, if you're living in Belfast or Bangor, you would be prepared to travel to the likes of Altnagelvin and Derry to have that lump seen to within, say, 36 hours. And I don't think any woman would decline that. Of course, transport is an issue. If you have a neurology problem, that speciality will be in Belfast. if you have a weight problem, or obesity or cardiovascular, that you would be prepared to travel to the Southwest Acute Hospital in Fermanagh. So you're going to have these specialist hubs. And the idea of those is that you will be seen quicker and that they will be helpful in tackling the waiting lists. But the hospitals that are perhaps in jeopardy are the general hospitals. And critics are saying that they're in jeopardy because of their geographical location. And that would be the likes of Daisy Hill, Swa, and Causeway. And then you've all the lots of the little local hospitals that are dotted around Northern Ireland as well, the smaller hospitals. It is a roadmap. It is a network of hospitals. But really, this consultation doesn't give you the detail in order for the public to be consulted and for the public to say, yeah, I like that, I don't like that. It's a little bit vague.
Mary-Louise, thank you very much. That's our health correspondent, Mary-Louise Connolly. Lindsay, listening to this morning, back to you and your dad, Lindsay. And I was just saying we ran out of time heading towards the 10 o'clock news there. Why don't we stay together and we'll report on Friday what the Belfast Trust has done or not for your father? Yeah. They say they're working on it.
Yeah, and it was just before we got cut off, Stephen, I was just saying that the care home issued the formal notice reluctantly, saying actually in writing that hopefully this will get the trust to move quicker in finding a suitable place for your father. So, you know, they didn't want to do this. It was a last resort to try and find him somewhere to go. So just our pressing matter is that we've got 3 days. We have to go and collect our father from a care home, and we've absolutely no idea where we're taking him. And the mental health unit would just be completely unsuitable.
Like, how is that in any way acceptable? The pressure on you already because of your dad, and like, it's this week. You've got to. You don't know what you're doing on Friday.
To me, an acceptable explanation isn't that he has to go somewhere and there's nowhere else for him. That's not acceptable by any, you know, maybe if he was distressed, he needed a review of his medication, he needed assessments, then maybe that could be a plausible reason. But there is no reason to place him in a unit like that. And it's just, I can't understand how we've come to this, that there's a system in place, a health service, that thinks that this is a reasonable answer or solution.
Lindsay, talk to you Friday. Thank you very much. Hopefully, let's see if you can get at least information before then. Thank you, Lindsay. Morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55. So we've a whole range of different issues that we're dealing with this morning. Let's come back to the business story. We were looking at business under pressure. A cost of business crisis is what the organisation Retail NI are describing it as. The chief executive of that entity, Glenn Roberts, with us this morning. Our business is really in crisis, Glenn?
Absolutely, Stephen. I mean, we took the time to survey our members, and over 400 of them responded on the basis of obviously the significant increases we're going to see in April with the national insurance hike, business rates increased, the living wage increases. I think what our survey showed that they're going to struggle because 74% of them said that, unfortunately, because of all these hikes, they're going to have to reduce staff numbers and staff hours. 86% of them said expansion plans, scale-up plans are going to be cancelled. That's restricting future employment opportunities for many in the community. And 96% of them were very clear about the Assembly. It's now time for the executive to turbocharge delivery on all of these areas. So, and I think the big thing that we need to say to the UK government is this. They said in their budget that this was all about protecting working people and promoting economic growth. On the basis of our survey, those two things will not happen. In fact, we will go backwards.
Look, you're not going to like the question that I'm about to put to you. But is there not part of this, Glenn, that the world has changed with online shopping, massive shopping outlets out of town where there's more convenient parking, that the high street is maybe more amenable to big businesses being turned into housing and social housing, and maybe you're fighting an uphill struggle here? And should we take money away from other vital services and pump it into a high street that's never going to be back to where you want it to be? The world has moved on.
Well, I don't believe that for one second. We're hosting a major high street summit today in Belfast. It's packed to capacity. And today it's all about looking at what the 21st century high street looks like. What are the opportunities? What are the challenges there? And we believe that if you want to tackle the challenge of online, you create experiences in our high streets, in our town centres. You make them fun, family-friendly destinations that people want to come back time and time again. That's how you beat the challenge back of online. I think also what we're setting out today is our five-point plan, what the executive can do to fix business rates, address the issue of business crime, recall the High Street Task Force, a range of other things that they could do that will help make a difference to our high streets and to our members.
But but that means money being diverted from somewhere else into business and helping businesses. So where do you take it from? Who loses out as a consequence? And the Department of Finance saying, they're saying this out loud, they're saying any rate relief means either forgoing revenue or charging other ratepayers.
Well, first thing, if you look at our plan, it is all cost-effective measures. So it's what it is. It's targeting the existing small business rate relief scheme and making it further. Removing the vacant property rate, which always rewards dereliction. It's about targeting existing resources, about issues like recalling the High Street Task Force so we can get that coordinated approach to High Street reconstruction. It's about the sentencing bill bringing forward for tougher, making the issue or the crime of assault of retail staff into law. It's about tougher fines for shoplifters. It's about setting up a cost of doing business advisory group. So there's a range of ideas that we have addressing planning, making sure that the planning system is fit for purpose to protect our town centres. Those don't cost money. Those are all about reprofiling existing budgets and existing schemes to make and target that relief to get it to the businesses that need it the most.
Are you hearing the right noises from Stormont?
Well, we have an MLA panel today, so we at our summit will be interested to hear what they say. We are going to obviously engage both in terms of Westminster and indeed Stormont as well with our ideas. But listen, be under no illusion. What is going to happen in the first week of April is going to hit this economy like a freight train. And you know, when you have a situation where, well, when you have over 74% of our members in the survey saying they're going to have to let people go, they're going to have to restrict staff hours. When you hear that 86% of our members are cancelling expansion plans, that's cancelling new jobs. Surely there is a problem. So what we're saying is this needs to be a wake-up call for politicians at all levels, is to take this cost of doing business crisis seriously. If you want to grow our economy, if you want to help working people, start supporting business. And that is a big takeaway from our event today to politicians at Stormont and at Westminster and indeed at local council.
How much, Glyn, would the support cost? Make it real.
Well, I think our proposals about changing the Small Business Rate Relief Scheme are not a million miles away from where the Department of Finance is. They released a discussion document very similar to what we have put forward. So what it is about ensuring there's a targeted approach to making sure, I mean, the current Small Business Rate Relief Scheme covers nearly every type of small business. We want to see that targeted to independent retail, hospitality and leisure to get it to the mainstays of our high street. So to get a little bit more relief to them, to help take the edge off what's going to happen in April, to get a coordinated approach to high street reconstruction. And that's why the High Street Task Force is so important, because it brought together executive, councils, business and other stakeholders to agree a coordinated approach. So a lot of this is about working better, it's about working smarter, and it's about working in greater partnership. And that doesn't cost anything.
David Honeyford, the Alliance MLA, listening to this today. Glyn said this doesn't all cost money. So yeah, that begs the question, why has it not been done, David? You're part of the executive.
We're part of the executive, but you don't have the finance ministry nor the economy ministry. So, you know, we're collectively part of the executive, but not part of those decisions. And we're calling for a lot of what, and have been calling for quite a while, for what Glyn has called for there. In the high street, we need a repurposing of our high street. We need a new vision of what that looks like in the 21st century. And that's a mixed use, where retail isn't the only anchor in our high streets, but you have people living there, you have hospitality in there, you have the arts in there, and you repurpose that. And that's the vision that Alliance has been putting forward over the last number of months.
Are you getting anywhere?
Well, we keep going on and on about it. But Stephen, how is it fair if you look at this? And Andrew Muir, as the minister, has brought forward a dilapidation bill, and that's where we are starting to make progress. And Alliance is starting to deliver on these issues. But if you look at that, how is it fair that a building that lies empty on our high street gets a rate relief, yet the business is struggling next door doesn't? There's something fundamentally wrong.
You know the logic. The business that's occupied and trading has profits with which to pay the rates. The business that is vacant, that's the logic, doesn't.
So what we have called for is a fundamental review of the non-domestic rating system that needs to be done from an outside body to look at this in the whole. So you look at the whole system to see what, and make a progressive system that those can afford to pay, and those who can't and need a bit of support, we get the support directly to them to support our high street. Because the opposite of the effects of this, if we lose people and more people in our high street, you actually generate less rates of income of tax, and you end up with people unemployed that cost government. So on one hand, if you don't support the business to allow them to be sustainable, on the other hand, you're paying it on a different part of your balance sheet. And that's the story of Northern Ireland. That's the story of health. That's the story of all the departments that go through. That if we want change, then we need to start delivering change. We can't stand and manifest those at elections saying we want change all the time. Alliance is delivering change without the dilapidation bill, and you're seeing other things coming through the environmental bill, but we need other ministries to start to deliver change. We can't just keep doing the same thing over and over and expect it to be different next year.
Commentator Phil Kelly listening to this. Your views, Phil. Good morning.
Well, yeah, good morning. I think any of your listeners, whether they live in Belfast or whether they live in small rural towns, will see the reality of what the high street looks like in their local vicinity. And it's really a visual representation of the failure of over a decade of economic policy by UK and local governments. And the pessimistic point of view is that's not going to change anytime soon with this latest government. But it's interesting that this plan talks about the living wage. Now, all these things are connected, a failing economy, but if workers' wages fail to keep up with prices, leaving less money in their pockets, they have less then to spend in local businesses. Ordinary people, as documented on your show for years, have seen their rent and mortgages go up, energy prices go up, grocery prices go up, while their wages are stagnating and actually falling in real terms. So the solution to this isn't easy, but it's interconnected. And to hear a business leader talk about, you know, the living wage threat to their business, the opposite is true, because if wages continue to be constrained, then that's going to have a devastating effect on the economy. It's interesting, the Alliance representative, the party who opposed beefing up workers' rights, voted against a trade union bill some years ago, but raises a point on dereliction. There is a major societal and economic cost to dereliction and vacancy, and we need government and local government to step in, because dereliction in UC Belfast City Centre is having an negative economic effect. So we need to be taking those properties out of the hands of...
Let me let you answer this.
Yeah, listen, I mean, firstly, I agree with Phil's points about the dereliction issue, but listen, it's not the living wage issue that we are particularly focused on. It is the massive increase in national insurance and business rates, and obviously living wage is part of that. If it was just the living wage increases on their own, our members could accommodate that. So that's not the issue here. We want to ensure staff get fair pay and a fair deal. There's absolutely no issue about this. And
the problem here is there is a solution here.
Let's let Glenn finish his point. Hold on.
And the biggest losers, according to our survey, with this national insurance hike, is going to be working people, because they're going to lose their jobs. So it's not the living wage. It is that national insurance hike. We already pay the most expensive business rate anywhere in the UK. So the situation even before April was incredibly difficult. So it's just this perfect storm of all of these cost issues. If it was just the national insurance increases on their own, I don't think there would be an issue.
And sadly, we live in a society, Stephen and Glenn, where your government will come for ordinary workers to squeeze them more. It will come for small businesses to squeeze them more while giving tax breaks to big corporations. You live in a country, the UK, where two-thirds of all wealth are owned by 50 families.
All right.
You know, where wealth inequality has a real-world effect, and you have a government that refuses to actually address that and redistribute wealth in a fair way, which means the pessimistic reality is they're going to come for small businesses and ordinary workers.
I'm sure there'll be more on this. Glenn Summitt is today. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, David. Thank you, Phil. 030-30-80-55-55. Now, if you're at the rugby at the weekend, did you smile? Did you go? Ireland's Six Nations game against Wales in Cardiff took place, and if you did attend, well, maybe you should have been smiling. For the first time, a network of temporary cameras were positioned across the city centre, transmitting your pictures and data, alerting police officers of anyone on a watch list. Some have said it's chilling and it's spying and it's Big Brother. Others don't really care. Madeline Stone from the UK Civil Liberties Campaign Group, Big Brother Watch, with us this morning. Morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Madeline, good morning. The former Senior Military Intelligence Officer, Philip Ingram. Morning, Philip.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Well, Madeline, look, if it's going to catch criminals and people up to all sorts, why should innocent people be concerned if they're being facially recognised going into a rugby match?
Well, this is essentially a biometric identity check to enter the city of Cardiff. It's, as you said, it's completely unprecedented. It's the first time anything like this has happened in the UK. And in fact, it's pretty much unprecedented in a democratic world. This is the kind of biometric surveillance setup that you have in China, that you have in Russia. It's unavoidable. And people, not just, you know, rugby fans, but people who live in Cardiff, people who are visiting places of worship, there's a court there, there's the Senate there, there's abortion clinics, there's all kinds of sensitive locations where people would have very strong expectations of privacy. And this is a totally untargeted network of surveillance systems. It's basically the same as having your ID checked or your fingerprint taken to enter the city. And that's not really how, you know, in a democratic society in the UK, how we do policing.
How does it harm us?
Step change.
How does it harm us? It's not invasive. Doesn't stop us what we're doing. Doesn't stop us at all. In fact, we don't know what's happening most of the time. So what's the harm? What is this data that could be detrimental to us?
It's incredibly invasive. And just because it's happening on a camera, essentially how it works is the camera and AI system makes a biometric map of your face that is compared against a watch list. It's basically the same as having your fingerprint taken. Just because it's not a physical action taking place, it is still a biometric identity check. And also, I mean, I think it's really important to know that people can be misidentified, and that is a very tangible harm. I have seen myself many people wrongly flagged as criminals by this technology, surrounded by police, and asked to prove their innocence, which is, you know, extraordinarily intrusive and stressful for people.
There's a few fundamental facts missed here. One, it's legally controlled under in England and Wales under the Protection of Freedoms Act. In Northern Ireland and Scotland, they're not subject to the Protection of Freedoms Act, but the PSNI have voluntarily signed up to that code. Two, whenever it takes an image of a face, it doesn't store it anywhere. It compares it against a database of known troublemakers, criminals, terrorists, and other things. And if you do not trigger on that database, it then doesn't go to the next level, which is a physical human being, a police officer, who will turn around and make an assessment as to whether they think that image is matches the person, a person of interest. So in effect, what you're doing is you're increasing the number of police officers patrolling the streets by a factor of 10 or 20 or 25 by using technology to help target potential persons of interest to physical police officers. And the police officers then make a decision as to what they do about it. This is the whole thing comes under a methodology of deciding whether it's proportionate, whether it's necessary to carry this out, and that's threat related, and whether the actions that are taken are proportional. And again, those are independently audited. So it's very easy to create scare tactics around it, but it's not storing the images of everyone that goes to the rugby or everyone that was in Cardiff. It's not holding them all in a database. It's only comparing something electronically that isn't even flagged up to a human being.
Let you respond very quickly, Madeline.
Or a subject of interest.
It's completely wrong to say this is governed by the Protection of Freedoms Act, I'm afraid. That act has nothing to do with facial recognition. And in fact, there is no law in the UK that mentions facial recognition. There is no legal safeguards around this. It's entirely up to police discretion. Police are writing their own policies about how it can be used, which is, you know, obviously extremely concerning when this makes so powerful You know, they urgently need to be reined in by the government. They urgently need legislation on this to protect our civil liberties and our privacy.
Madeline, thank you. Philip, thank you. Before we go this morning, the Education Minister, Paul Given, is responding to the news that a man has been charged with harassment. The Education Minister has told the Nolan Show the following. On the 7th of February, I alerted police to a series of malicious emails regarding Lisneal College. This is not acceptable, says Mr. Given. The harassment of public representatives undermines democracy and discourages others from putting themselves forward for public life. I am well used to being in the midst of political crossfire. However, the emails that I've received over the past few weeks have been based on inaccurate information. Public representatives have the right to carry out their work without harassment. It is disappointing that despite having explained on numerous occasions that minor works projects have been carried out at schools across Northern Ireland in line with normal procedures, some continue to imply that I have been involved in the decision-making process and suggest there's been a lack of transparency. Today, says Paul Given, I will be doing my job as always. I will not be bullied or deterred from serving the people of Northern Ireland as Education Minister. And that coming in to the Nolan Show from the Education Minister when we learn that a 62-year-old man has been charged with harassment against Paul Given. The charge follows a report to police of abusive emails, alleged abusive emails, on the 7th of February. Listen, thank you very much for your company today. We'll see you all tomorrow when we start at 9 o'clock. Have a good day.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
Well, it's very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.